Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Guy McPherson. I'm going solo tonight. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like most future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Background music for a couple of our segments, including the next one, is provided by Rianne Farragon. Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. I'll include a single story tonight. From Zero Hedge comes this headline from last Thursday. U.S. government order of 160,000 hazmat suits gives a clue. It includes these lines. Now that Ebola is officially in the U.S. on an uncontrolled basis, the two questions on everyone's lips are, one, who will get sick next? And two, how bad could it get? We don't know the answer to question number one just yet. But when it comes to the second one, a press release 3 weeks ago from Lakelands Industries, a manufacturer and seller of a comprehensive line of safety garments and accessories for the industrial protective clothing market, may provide some insight into just how bad the U.S. State Department thinks it may get. Because when the U.S. government buys 160,000 hazmat suits specifically designed against Ebola, just ahead of the worst Ebola epidemic in history making U.S. landfall, one wonders, what do they know that we don't? Well, I suspect one of the things they know that most Americans don't know is that the airline passenger who brought Ebola into the U.S. initially went to a Dallas emergency room last week, but was sent home despite telling a nurse that he had been in disease-ravaged West Africa. This, according to the hospital, as reported by the Associated Press 1 week ago today. A medical doctor from Missouri is sounding the alarm. Dr. Gil Mobley, a microbiologist and emergency trauma physician, cleared security in the Atlanta airport wearing a mask, goggles, gloves, boots, and a hooded white jumpsuit emblazoned on the back with the words, CDC is lying. Of course, they're lying. CDC is part of the United States government. As reported by USA Today 4 years ago, the Obama administration has quietly scrapped plans to enact sweeping new federal quarantine regulations that the CDC touted as critical to protecting Americans from dangerous diseases spread by travelers. Along with the corporate media, the corporate government lies to protect its interests, the profits. Most Americans remain willfully ignorant, and as I indicated a couple of weeks ago, it's perfectly understandable. As I said, taking any meaningful action against imperialism will prove painful. There's no personal advantage to admitting, much less acting upon or against, American empire. A line from Nietzsche comes to mind. Sometimes people don't want to hear the truth because they don't want their illusions destroyed. That's it for News Beyond the Mainstream. As regular listeners know by now, we offer brief opinion pieces each week. In Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue. This week's contribution comes from a regular voice on this show. My colleague Forrest Palmer brings up a topic most people will consider disgusting, but American empire is disgusting, and essentially nobody seems to mind or even notice.
Night soil. Two words you have more than likely never heard come from an environmental group as a possible solution to one of the almost countless problems that are increasingly becoming a part of our daily lives. As the food system of this industrial capitalist society is totally dependent on fossil fuels and petrochemicals, for thousands of years previous to now, various civilizations used night soil, which is human excrement, for agricultural purposes. Although there is some debate on whether or not using human waste is a safe practice for growing food, the fact of the matter is that it is still used today in many places, and most of the fear is founded upon societal disgust in dealing with human waste. In addition, we know scientifically about the chemical effects of certain types of waste on soil, safety practices, and the like will give us the ability to actually treat our waste instead of blindly using it with little regard to the consequences. Hence, it will behoove us as a global society to start to devise local sanitation systems and agricultural practices around the recycling of our waste in a true closed-loop system. The ultimate problem, though, is that once the momentarily advanced city-states of the Western world were able to just send their waste away with the push of a handle, they're concerned about solid waste from humans went only as far as whether or not it was being dumped next to their housing or in their drinking water. But as millions of daily flushes become less and less over the next few years, and using the life's blood of fresh water to send our refuse away to parts unknown will finally be seen as utter lunacy from a sustainable standpoint, humans and Westerners specifically will be up a certain type of creek with no paddle, and it will be excrement of our own making. As such, we will have to do something with it, whether we want to face it or not. Over the next few years, the litmus test as to how serious or honest the leaders in the environmental movement are will be directly determined by how willing they are to discuss what will be the only options in many facets of our lives in which we have become so used to having choices. And the understanding by the people of the dire situation we reside in presently will be determined by how willing they are to accept these options instead of blindly following people and institutions that tell them what they want to hear and not the truth. Because I'm sad to say, if other things aren't quickly addressed, this will more than likely be the least of our worries.
Okay, for this segment of the show, I'm going to have a conversation with Peter Melton and Reese Jones. Peter Melton is currently living in Santa Cruz, California, and after hearing me speak in April of this year, he decided he needed more of that for reasons that are completely unclear to me. And so he hosted me on my recent tour through the Central and Northern California coast area, and also extending as far up as Ashland, Oregon. So, Peter, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Guy. Pleasure to be on the show, as always, and to meet you, Miss Reese.
And I also have with me Reese Jones. Reese has interviewed me several times, and those clips can be found on the blog, GuyMcPherson.com, under recent interviews. And Reese lives in coastal Southern California, and we will have an informal conversation for the next 40 minutes or so between the three of us. So thank you for joining us, Reese. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And I want this to be as informal as possible, so I want you to interrupt and chime in and give me your perspectives as we go along, because people hear my perspective all the time, and I suspect they're mostly tired of that, even if they are listening in.
Yes, so let me interrupt right there. Reese, you and I haven't got to meet yet, so I'd like your 2 minutes of how you heard about Guy and what caused you to be so active in sharing his message.
Right. Well, you know, it's so interesting because I was looking at my browser crash the other day in anticipation of this. I was studying permaculture, and I ended up seeing Paul Beckwith, and then I ended up seeing Guy McPherson.
And were these video clips that you were looking for information about permaculture and you came across something unexpected?
Yes, and you know, there might have been some Facebook involvement. I'm not sure. I cannot remember exactly.
Well, that's great. That's very similar to what happened to me. A friend of mine, Robbie Patterson, you're guilty, sent me some information about Fukushima and a link to a YouTube about Fukushima. And I was watching that, and then on the side I saw something that said runaway climate change. And I thought, wow, I haven't checked in on the climate change front yet, and runaway doesn't sound so good. And so I watched a video about runaway climate change, which led me to a video about Guy, and I got swept away.
Exactly.
So we recommend that as a path to getting hooked on Guy.
Hooked on Guy.
And so, Reese, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about what happened next. You know, you saw a video, you came across my work, you watched a little bit, presumably you let that settle in for a while, or maybe not. What were your next steps in terms of enlightenment or action, or what happened to you then?
Well, you know, it's rather intriguing what you have to say, and so I immediately embarked on thorough examination of who you were and trying to find verification for what you were saying and all of that. You know, it was really, I don't know, it was rather shocking, and yet it was very entertaining as well. And then in researching the information that you were sharing, I said, well, this is very important for those I care about to know about and to judge for themselves whether or not to believe you or not. And so the rest is history, I suppose.
Right, although you didn't stop there. You then contacted me.
Oh, yes. And the reason was, is I actually saw a lot of your videos, and they didn't answer the questions that people were asking me and that I wanted to know. And so I said, oh, golly, what to do? And then I asked online a bit and then finally said, well, I've got to call him immediately and see if he'll talk to me and answer some questions. And it was really important that family, friends, and the other people that I care about at least get a gander at you.
And Reese, what background do you have for doing any of this? Or tell us what got you here that way?
Oh, well, I absolutely love the Earth, and I study that in my studies, and along with technology. So, you know, I love the environment, but I also love empire. So, I don't know, that's a dilemma, isn't it?
A wee bit.
But I think we're all there. Everybody who is embedded with this system, with this imperial system, who does have an appreciation or even a love for nature, is right there in the same spot. I mean, we're stuck with empire. We were born into this set of living arrangements. We didn't vote for it. It just sort of happened to us.
Yeah, like today at lunch, I was texting somebody, and he said, I used to think that was so rude when people would text while I was with them. And then he went on to say.
And then somebody gifted me with a smartphone just within the last month or so, and holy cow. I'm driving around texting. I can't get myself away from it. I'm just addicted to it. If I was in a classroom now as a student, I would never put the damn thing away. I would never listen to the professor. There's a lot of important stuff happening on my Facebook feed and so on. I can't be getting behind on that. And I'm just astonished at what I have become. I have become the person I railed against as little as 6 weeks ago. It's ripping my heart out.
And so now Guy is texting people, telling them they should stop texting.
Yes, exactly.
So will you both be getting the watch?
Say that again?
Will you both be getting the watch on your wrist?
Oh. We're a few years behind the curve on that front, so it'll be a while before we're that stage. But sure, later. Or if someone exactly. wants to gift us one, say it wasn't our fault.
And it took me a long time to catch up. You know, I got my first cell phone probably about 5 years ago, and then got this smartphone well behind anybody else. So hopefully I'll be far enough behind on the watch thing that the whole imperial set of living arrangements will be done by then.
Okay, enough of that. Reese, I have a question for you. Enough banter about our technical whatever we are. So you got to ask Guy a whole bunch of questions that you thought were unanswered, and you got to put a bunch of videos on his site and stuff. You're a famous videographer now and interviewer. Now that he's answered the questions for you, how does this sit with you?
Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, nobody can really say that the world is going to come to an end, and guaranteed. Maybe they can, and maybe they're right, but, you know, there's so many people who have so much what you call hopium. They just believe...
Yeah, but the question was, where are you, and not where are you in the future. Where are you now? How does it feel to be you now?
Oh, fine. I take it all in stride, actually. I haven't suffered from depression, if that's what you mean, or anything like that. There was a while there that I thought... Oh, this is horrid, you know. It really was awful, and those I love dearly, I was really concerned about.
Are you on the radio now? Right. Well, it's a cause for great concern. And some people do get mired in despair and are depressed, but other people come to grips with what is, with this reality in a relatively short period of time. And it sounds like you did that. It's sort of for me, it's been described as a Buddhist perspective, or to quote from the title of Byron Katie's latest book, Loving What Is. So it's just an acceptance of where we are and an acknowledgement that There's nothing you or I or any other three people can do about it. And so it sounds like you reached that acceptance early on in your stage of discovery.
Well, exactly. You know, it's like that a phrase that I absolutely love now. It's care, but don't carry. Does that make sense to you?
That's awesome.
That's a good one.
Sort of the Buddhist equivalent would be not being attached to any outcome.
Right. Exactly. If you cannot do anything about it immediately, then there's really no point in worrying about it.
Right, and that's so paradoxical, because here we are saying, you're dead, your life is over, this is all going to come crumbling down sooner than you would have hoped or ever imagined, not just for you, but for everybody and the whole species and maybe all species. And yet, something about hearing that and sitting with that leads most people eventually to this place of calm, a place of surrender. We were given a talk in Monterey last week, and we had a couple of guys who were in the Marines at the talk. And afterwards, I was chatting with them, and he said, "We've already accepted the death thing. We did that every day in Iraq and Afghanistan." He said the captain would say to us, "You know, some of you guys are going to be dead at the end of today, and you just have to know that. And it might be you, or it might be your buddies, but here we go." And so he gave a whole different perspective, you know, from that military place, from that I'm going to war place, and not knowing what the day will hold, which brings us to this incredible place of presence. When you let go of what am I doing for the future, and you get in the moment and say, wow, we took a walk in the park before this interview, and it's like, man, just listening to a babbling brook or hearing the wind through the leaves, there's so much beauty to be taken in and to be part of with this earth, our humanity, and all the other species, that we get present to that is the nirvana.
Yes. Do you think of doing good? For example, I know people worked for climate change, you know, and the carbon credits and all that. But what about saving animals and actually doing very much good? There's lots to do if this is coming to pass. Do you think?
Well, of course, there's always lots to do. And I think that, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, taking right action, regardless of the outcomes, sort of detaching yourself from the outcome, but taking right action, I think, is an appropriate step. And often we don't know what that is. We don't know what right means. So we have this, I guess, moral code or ethical code that is within us that has been planted or placed or has developed within us as a result of the culture we're in, where we're embedded within. So, you know, determining what's right within the context of this system that has so many things wrong is pretty challenging. But I think taking those right actions, taking those steps, is what we have to remain true to, regardless of the outcome. Very, very frequently, somebody asks after I deliver a presentation, won't people simply become hedonists when they adopt your message? If they actually believe that we are going to die relatively soon, won't they become hedonists? And I have a couple of comments I make. One is that Americans become hedonists. How would I tell the difference? And the other is that I think people will do what they do because of whatever moral and ethical code is instilled within them regardless. And certainly my message has never been to simply capitulate to hedonism because of what I know. And part of that is because I don't think it's all about us. Yeah, I don't think it's all about relatively wealthy white people, especially rich white men. I don't think this whole thing, this whole planetary experiment called life, really is about the relatively few of us. And so I'm trying to not make it about the relatively few of us and extend my actions and the outcome of my actions to non-human species as well as my neighbors, the people I spend time with.
Well, Peter and Guy, how do you both feel about all of this now?
Well, from my standpoint, this is Peter, for those of you still recognizing voices, you know, last in the spring, I spent 5 straight days with Guy, and now 6 months later, I've been, this is our 8th day together, or 9th day together, 24/7, and I don't recommend that. I have survived. It continues to settle in me in a deeper and deeper and more inspiring way as conversations with people at these meetings that we do, whether they're 6 people or last night 130 people came to our talk, more and more what comes out is, you know, here's a little bit of science. In general, we agree with the science that sometime in 10 to 50 years is going to be a completely different world. That's all anybody has to agree with, is that general statement to then bring up, how does that feel? Who do you become amidst all of this? And what keeps moving through me is just how incredibly connecting, inspiring, presence creating. It's just so deep to look someone in the eye, even a complete stranger who had just talked about this with, look them right in the eye and say, how does it move through you? Much like I just did with you. It's become my question, if you will. How does it feel to be you right now? And everyone's going through it at different paces and different process, and it's bringing up different stuff. But for me, I'm fired up. Today, I'm so fired up today. We were watching, if you've heard of Katie Goodman, broad comedy. She's a hilarious comedian, musician.
And social critic.
And social critic with her music. And a guy was playing us her song. Can we say the F word?
Yes, we can say the F word.
Her song, I Didn't Fuck It Up, is the name of her song, Katie Goodman. And it's a beautiful song about our social situation. So a guy was playing this song, and then I said, that girl's so great, we got to call her. I went to her website, pulled up her contact info, I sent an email. Less than an hour or hour and a half at the most after I sent the email, the phone rings. It's Katie Goodman calling us, wondering how she might connect with what we're up to, how we might connect with what she's up to. She's talking all about this these end times, and she wants to play with us. And so that kind of thing, I think we're at the very front edge of a massive wave of people catching on to this and wanting to do their part, wanting to add their creativity. In Katie's song, you can find on YouTube, but the gist of it is, I didn't F it up, you didn't F it up,
but whoever they are, they
effed it up. Now it's effed up.
But you never thought you'd be hearing us sing on the radio show.
That's right, we're singing. Yes, folks, we do play requests. So it's just hilarious. She's on stage with her guitar, and she's singing about how it's all effed up. And then she has another song after that about how she loves men who drive Hummers, and she does that reverse news, like Stephen Colbert kind of thing. And the other, what's the other song was, this new one. She said, you got to go hear my new one. It's All Okay is her new one, where she goes Pollyanna on us, and she says, hey, it's all okay, we have a tambourine. You know, and they sing this song, and they're all in Nancy Sinatra outfits, and they're just playing 60s doo-wop, it's all okay, even though all the animals are dying, even though
we're 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, even though it's obviously really a horribly dire situation, hey, we have a tambourine.
It's all messed up, but I'm okay. It's okay, everybody. We have a tambourine.
It's going to be okay. And so more of that Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, reverse psychology sort of thing to get people thinking about important issues of the day.
Right, and to use humor to help people to dare to go there, because it's a bit of a hurdle when you want to talk to people about the possibility that what we've done to the climate could end all habitat for humans and all the other species. And so you use humor to get to open the door, and then you've got a different situation. All that to say, I'm flipping having the time of my life.
Really?
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I feel so free now to talk to people about it. And we're going to be filming, actually, as soon as we're done here, we're filming a couple of comedy skits. We came up with our first working name for our comedy troupe, which is the Grim Reapers Comedy Climate Hour. And And we're looking at every different way that might introduce this concept to people that, hey, we've got to dare, you know, watching all these YouTubes and everybody saying, oh, we're in really bad shape. We really need to do something quick. Now, you know, let's go back to the game. Or, you know, there so many people are saying, you know, just like this march that happened, hey, we're in big trouble. We got to do something. So what about that recycling, or what about that solar power or something? They stop at this point where they say we're in big trouble. They don't extrapolate out what big trouble means. And this is how, when I introduce Guy, this is what I'm saying is Guy has dared to go past that point that says we're in big trouble and start doing the math on what will happen when the weather keeps going up and how that will affect the human and habitat for all other species as well.
Well, Peter, what do you think about that? Do you agree with Guy entirely?
Well, I will admit that I have not, you know, studied anywhere near the 30 years that Guy studied. In fact, it's only been a year since I first connected with Guy's stuff. So I can't claim to be an expert in any way. But when, much like you, when I heard him talk, it resonated. It makes sense to me that the changes we've already seen at 0.85, if that gets doubled, if we get to 1.5 or 2, the changes we're going to face are going to be astronomical. It just that resonates with me. And to know that he's been studying this for 30 years to the point where he's daring to go out and tell people, I think there's got to be a decent measure of possible accuracy there. And it resonates with me that this is, to some degree, feels like my next calling, is that my job is to share this concept with people. And like Guy always says in his talks, if I'm wrong, then what happens? If he's wrong, what happens is we've got a deeper sense of who we are, and we know now how we have to move forward. And plus, if he's wrong, all that really means is that we're going to blow up in 80 years instead of 30 or 10 or whatever number you want to pull out of the hat. You know? Well,
and that's an important point, too, Peter. Frequently, people focus on a date, on a time, you know, as if our expiration date is January 2nd. 2030 or whatever. And that's really not the point of my message at all. It's not about the date. It's about how we live with death in mind. Because even if all the science and all the models and everything else I quote are incorrect or are off by decades, the message remains the same. And I think the message for many people, including you, Peter, is quite liberating. It leads you to do things that maybe you wouldn't have done previously, and it allows you and I to engage in conversation with people about what it means to be a human, about what kind of humanity comes up in you as a result of contemplating the fact that, in fact, you are going to die, and we're all going to die, and it's not really very long from now, and it's never been very long from now. Because that's the nature of the human experience. And so I want to turn this question back to you, Rhys, and ask you how the message has affected you. Has it been liberating? Did you just sort of accept the notions and then move on, and it wasn't that big a deal because for a long time you've known you were going to die? I mean, what's your reaction to the message other than doing this series of interviews with me and with Paul Beckwith and maybe others are in the queue and trying to get more information? What has been the more visceral response that you've had?
Well, there seems to be some sort of justice in this. And what we're doing to the earth and to the animals and to children and everything is monstrous in many ways. And we allow it to happen, and the court systems allow people to be freed to do again the horrors and atrocities they committed, you know, to get into the prison. Can civilization really survive when you do such terrible things to each other and to innocent creatures of the earth? Is there a morality to this? And so when you spoke and I saw others felt similarly to you, there was an awful justice to it, as if we're a carcinogen, a cancer, a mold, or a fungus upon this planet in some ways, you know, not in all ways. Not to not say that There's so many extraordinarily wonderful people, you know. Well, it's rather horrific, don't you think?
Well, yes. I mean, I hate for everybody to suffer as a result of the decisions made by a relatively few. But certainly, given what we civilized, mostly white people, are doing to people of color throughout the world, are doing to uncivilized, pre-civilized, whatever, cultures throughout the world, are doing to the non-human species about the world. It seems that somebody should pay. I just don't think it should be all of us.
Right. No, is that's another injustice, isn't it? I really don't want all of us to disappear, and I keep being reminded of the biblical phrase, "And the meek shall inherit the earth." Might they be humans? Might they be animals? What do you think?
Yeah, you bring up an excellent topic that is now becoming really part of where we go with the talks is, if you say, what does this mean to you? You know, when we start to dig in like we're doing here, when we take an hour to actually through some of the layers, you get to this point that says, well, wait a minute. What is my spirituality? What is my religion around this? What is my belief in Creator? How does my spiritual belief tie into what's going on? What kind of God does this or doesn't do this? You know, people start to ponder their spiritual connection and how climate change and this possible probable extinction thing plays into their spiritual lives. So you quoted a Bible quote, and there's a bunch of them about being stewards to the earth, about loving your neighbor and loving your enemy and all these different things, but mostly just the stewarding of the earth that, you know, the Christian God, which is so strong a presence in our Western culture, you know, asks us to steward the earth. We haven't done a very good job there. So my Christian upbringing makes me wonder, what does that mean for, you know, for my future afterlife, if I qualify as someone who was part of all of that? So I think it raises amazing spiritual questions along with the emotional and physical questions. And that also, I guess you could stay on that for another minute, is my personal spirituality is much more open, non-denominational, almost Buddhist kind of thing that continues to look for, what is the spirituality that makes this all make sense? What is the metaphor that makes this make sense? How can this make sense in a deeper spiritual way? And I'm still grappling with that, but I'm hoping to find insight on that.
Well, one rather interesting take on this is that we were put upon Earth to actually find a way to glorify love and universe and God, and that we had a choice to make whether to choose the good and the God and the love and kindness and all of that, or to choose our own will, our animal cravings and desires, whether we give in to all of it, you know? Does what I'm saying make any sense to either of you?
Yeah, definitely. There's lots of different angles around that, and I'd ask you to flush that out one more level. You know, if we're brought here to what? We're this individual emanation of spirit, call it what you may. We're these children of God. We're these light beings, you know, from whatever dimension, whatever angle you come from on this. We're human on this planet, and we have this amazing gift of our sentience, of our ability to know that we're here, our self-awareness. So I ask you to go one level deeper with what you were just saying.
In what way exactly are you referring to?
Well, go back to what you were just saying.
All right.
Repeat the first couple of lines of what you were just saying.
Well, let's see. Supposedly, we were given a choice to choose evil or good. And that's that's the gist of it. You know, we each individually have choices to make. We are here to find out whether or not we could live strictly on our own without spiritual guidance, without good and God. Or can we survive on our own with our own intelligence and our cleverness and our will and our pride? That sort of
thing. Right. So to state that is to say to some degree that the Creator set it up that way. If the universe set it up that way, what does that mean? What does that bring out in you? So the universe, to whatever degree some people believe we're all connected to the universe, it's all one energy, whether that's the case or whether there's some outside force driving this, it set it up. Allowed for, to some degree, this free will situation.
Right, because there is darkness. There's undoubtedly, if you just study science, I suppose, one can see that there's utter devastating darkness, devoid of anything and everything, and it's this extraordinary feeling of emptiness that is, you know, people have experienced it, supposedly in traveling and through dreams and that sort of thing, or dying. And what an interesting thing is, I saw the white light. I went through that experience. Did either of you ever experience anything like that?
You mean a near-death experience?
Yes.
Not really. I never had this sort of see the light experience, the tunnel. I never went that far. I've been in some pretty significant accidents. I've never had that response that the scientists attribute to biochemistry.
Right, but what I do see in you, Guy, and when I hear you talk about this general category, is that when you live with death in mind, which is the subtitle of the new book, The Extinction Dialogues, when you experience death, now some people do the white light thing or see themselves above the operating table or those different stories that are around, that's one physical experience. But another experience that happens, I think, through our emotional body maybe and through our mental process, is that when we live with the knowingness that we are going to die, that we have a certain near-death experience that is self-generated in our own mind, in our own psyche, in our own emotional body and spiritual body. That's what we're asking. That's what we're basically creating with this message, is create your own near-death experience by realizing that you always know you were going to die. Nobody gets out alive. We've just learned to take it all for granted, and that isn't benefiting us at all.
Well, one thing to notice, if you have experienced the white light, is that actually it's not near death, but it's actually full life. Does that sound rather odd?
That's exactly what we're saying. You're the lucky one. You get to die, and what that means is you get to live.
And so I really strongly encourage people to live. To experience those moments, to help create those moments that you're going to remember before you die. And so for me, it's from that line out of the Shawshank Redemption, which is so old now, essentially none of my listeners will have any memory of it. Get busy living or get busy dying. And so I try to live in a different way than I was living before, a more aware way, a more stop and smell the roses, stop and observe the beauty of the world kind of way. To the extent I can get away from that stupid smartphone.
And that's like the bucket list kind of thing that movie came out and took people by storm, which was live with death in mind. So the guy finds out he's going to die and he goes and does all the things he wished he'd always would do. And he quits being a grumpy old man and realizes that it's okay to feel the love of friends and strangers and loved ones. And it might be actually healing to try to heal some relationships that are incomplete. So these are the things that come about every moment when you live with death in mind.
Yes, absolutely. And the point was, there might be something beyond. And the light itself is this extraordinary love that is indescribable. There's no explanation. There's nothing anyone can say to describe the feelings of a godly love or whatever it is. It defies reality, actually.
Right, and I think you're right on there to another part, and we keep digging deeper into this matrix, into this puzzle, is that, for me, my current position on this is that when we die, we realize that we were so much more than we thought we were. And that's what I think when you talk about the white light and people experiencing this otherworldly, God-like love energy, that when we die, we get to experience that. And when we experience that, we get to realize, oh my God, the whole time I was a human, I was really so much more than just a human.
Not just us, but the animals as well.
Well, yes, thank you. It all translates out to all of creation is this magic light show. All of creation is this beauty unfolding in this illusion of linear time, that the infinite has pushed itself and crammed itself and packaged itself into this tiny little fragment, this tiny little show that we think is everything. And yeah, it's, well, I have to go back to the butterfly caterpillar analogy. Imagine one caterpillar saying to another caterpillar, no, really, you're going to go into this little cocoon thing, and when you come out, you're going to be all bright colors, and you're going to fly around, light on the wind. Really, that's who you are. You're a butterfly, cleverly disguised as a caterpillar.
Yeah, and also, I think that it is a reminder, and I'm sorry to bring this up, but as long as there is a light, there is also a dark. And I suppose that was the point of our spiritual talk. There is this absolute beauty, and then as if we're given a choice to choose this absolute beauty, or do we choose the other side? Does that make sense?
Yes, so it definitely makes sense, and there's many religious and, I guess, spiritual beliefs that package it that way. And it really resonates with a lot of people that there's the good and the evil and the dark and the light. Personally, it doesn't resonate so much with me, but that doesn't make it right or better or anything. Everyone, I think that part of our journey of being individuated is that we get to experience the world our own way and that there's no right or wrong way to do it.
And I'm a rationalist, and I've been a rationalist for a long time, and yet I started going dark with three quotes. One of them was from the poet Mary Oliver, and the line is, someone I loved once gave me a box full of darkness. It took me years to understand that this too was a gift. And so even though I don't have this sort of outlook that most people would call spiritual, I recognize that there is a shadow, to use the psychological term for it. There's a darkness within each of us, and that applies to societies as well as individuals. I think we constantly battle as individuals with what is right, with what is determining what is right. And of course, we're so overwhelmingly influenced by the culture in which we're embedded, as well as our genes, our genetics. And, you know, those are the two factors that influence who we are and what we do. And in everybody is the potential to do horrible things to other people. In everybody is the potential to do amazing, wonderful, positive things for other people and for non-human organisms. So we all, it appears to me that we all have this capacity for doing horrible things, and we also have within us this capacity for doing amazing and amazingly wonderful things. So, you know, some people call that the light and the dark. Whatever you want to call it, it's there. It's there in all of us. I don't know very many people who completely lack empathy, and I don't know very many people who can completely turn away from the dark side either, who turn out looking and sounding like the Dalai Lama, for example, or these other great spiritual leaders that we turn to for their wonderful actions.
I suppose that's what they mean by transcension of the opposites.
Yes, I agree. And it's just a stunningly, overwhelmingly difficult thing to accomplish. We are human animals. We need a certain number of things to survive and also to thrive. And within us, as a result of our evolutionary past, is a set of behaviors, some of which are really horrible. And they are selected for, or we wouldn't have them. And so overcoming them is what Nietzsche referred to as the Übermensch, or the Superman, or the Overman. The ability to overcome those terrible behaviors built into us by evolution makes one the Superman. And as you might conclude from the term itself, it ain't easy being the Superman.
No. So, Guy, for going dark, is that what you're talking about, this going dark spiritually, emotionally, and globally?
Well, yes, going dark in the book refers to all levels of that darkness. Industrial civilization is about to have the lights go out. Our species is about to have the lights go out. As individuals, we've known since we were 5 or 10 years old that we are mortal too, that nobody gets out alive, that ultimately the lights will go out on us. And it'll be a stunningly short time for all of us, even if we live to be 100. So what is that? What kind of response does that generate in people is the question then. And one of the questions I try to answer. And that, to be fair, Carolyn Baker's answers much more completely and much better in the book I recently have out with her, Extinction Dialogues. She's wiser than I am. A little bit older and a lot wiser. So it was quite a pleasure creating that book with her.
And what did she say about that?
Well, you got to get the book for that, for God's sake.
Oh, right.
Or wait, we could read a few pages. Carolyn has been studying this depth for a long time, and she's worked with people from the eco-psychological aspects and the spiritual aspects to do what we're doing here. Dare to spend a few extra minutes digging deeper into what's it feel like and what program shows up and what kind of denial shows up or what kind of urge to tangent off somewhere shows up and who do we become when we dare to sit with this and sit still and just say, wow, so we're killing over 150 species every day. That's what humanity and our industrial civilization is doing. How do I feel about that? How do I feel about that? I guess it's, dang, I don't want to admit that I have any part of that. I really don't want to hear the names or understand much more about that. Let's put that one on the back shelf because I don't really want to do it, but when the commercial shows up saying send $30 for the Panda Relief Fund because it's endangered, I might send $30 to the Panda Fund so that I feel like I did something.
And you did something. That panda might have a better life because of you and your gift.
Yes, but we... It feels like, again, this is just us daring to throw up the next thought that comes up,
right.
Is that, yeah, I might save a panda. Whoops, there's 150 other species that died today. Right. And that we don't want to look at the whole picture. We want to look at a little chunk of it that we might feel that we could be okay about. I'm going to recycle. I'm going to compost. I'm going to ride my bike more often. I'm going to hit like on a Facebook post or something. All these different things that could help us feel a little bit better about a small part of the puzzle.
And that's a big part of anthropocentrism, of to take it a step further, humanism. We are afflicted by this notion that we're the important ones, that this whole set of living arrangements, that this entirety of the earth is all about us. And that's kind of weird when you think about it, when you consider that if you stretch your arms as wide as you can, and have that represent the timeline of Earth, the time that Earth has been here, then the human experience is the last few cells at the end of your middle finger. That's it. So to conclude that Earth is here for us, to serve us, is the very height of hubris, it seems to me. And so not taking actions that acknowledge the importance of the living planet seems to be a slight oversight. Making this all about us seems to be just a little bit arrogant to me. Civilizations don't last forever, and neither do species, as it turns out. It's not just individuals that get an expiration date when they're born, although we don't know what it is, of course. It's also species, and individual species don't last forever. The Earth isn't going to last forever. So, deal with it. You know, this is reality. This is the reality we're in. Blah, 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 blah. That's what I was saying. Blah, blah, blah.
A lot of blah. That's, it's fun. We got to give ourselves the space to throw up in it, to just barf out whatever comes up as that next thought and not have to feel like it's going to be perfect radio or perfect conversation or that it's even going to be right or it's even going to be what you believe the minute after you say it. Right? It's just about saying, oh boy, right now I feel this, or this is the thought that crosses my mind when you talk about good and evil. Blah, this is what comes up, you know, and we dare to expose ourselves. We dare to be transparent. And we dare also to take a big bite of impermanence, getting back to Buddhism. You know, and that's another major tenet there, is that this is all temporary. We know this is all temporary. We know that it's 99% empty space in between all the atoms dancing around. We know this is, to some degree, one big dream, one big dance, one big illusion on the infinite scale. But yet we make humanity so important. We make our individual life so important that we don't care for our own planet. We don't care for any of the other species. We pretend to care about the panda bears when it comes on TV, but I wouldn't have done it if it didn't come on TV. And we've desensitized ourselves to the whole magic of living.
Wow. Well, none of it is blah, 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 blah. I was just thinking and pondering as you were talking, Guy and Peter. So, very thought-provoking, actually.
Yeah, but when we minimize it, it allows us to just exhale a little bit, and that's part of having fun with it all, is that while this could be the most serious thing I've said in months, at the same time I could also just say blah, 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 blah.
Oh, right, of course.
Okay. So it's all about taking it, having a lightness about it, that we're not taking it all so seriously. Even our own extinction, we have to look at from a different perspective, from the infinite perspective that says, oh, they thought they were going to live forever? Didn't we make that pretty clear? Hasn't every single other person died? And civilization died and empire died. I thought these were the wise apes.
Right. Well, with that, we're verging on
the end.
The end.
So that was another fun thing, though, when somebody came in late to one of the talks the other day.
Yes. Somebody mentioned that they had arrived late, or they were expected to be late, or something like that. And who was it?
I forget who it was, but they came in, or even who said it, or they said that, well, when you come into a Guy McPherson talk, you always come in at the end.
It's always the end.
It's always the end. Da 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 da. How's the jingle go? I always miss that.
It's in the movie,
but I forget right. How it goes.
And the belt.
Right.
He's also his friend and navigator and so on. The belt yells out after Guy, the protagonist, says the end. The belt goes, dun, dun, dun.
Right.
So we're trying to get people to do that whenever I say the end. Everybody in the audience could, every time I say the end, chime in with, I think that'd be awesome.
We could recommend another plug for that movie, The Croods, C-R-O-O-D-S, amazing animated movie about change and coming out of the box, coming out of the cave to see a whole new world.
Wow. I want to see it, The Croods.
You should. We could talk about it next time.
Yes, there's always a next time, even if it is the end.
Dun, dun, dun.
There, finally getting into the spirit. All right. We ought to wrap this up. We're verging on the end of our time here for the interview, and we won't even talk about the end of our time for the rest of it. Thank you very much, Rhys Jones, calling in from Southern California. Thank you very much, Peter Melton, sitting here with me today.
At the 100th Monkey Bookstore, oddly enough. So we're in quite the spiritual zone here about the 100th Monkey, which, of course, is the fable of that critical mass where we get it.
Right. This show is actually being broadcast a few days after it's recorded in the 100th Monkey. By the time you hear this on the air, I'll be home in the mud hut.
Ah, yes. Sending you home.
So again, thank you, Rhys.
Thank you.
And thank you, Peter. Oh, you're welcome, Peter.
I was kidding to you.
And thank you, Guy, for having us on your show. I like to interrupt. It's so fun to interrupt Guy. You guys on the radio who don't get to interrupt him, you don't know what you're missing.
It's great fun for every party, including me.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you both. It's been a pleasure having you on Nature Bats Last Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, batter, batter, batter. Swing!
Each week, we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful and useful information. Our doomer for this week is Kitty Ball, who recently posted a comment on the Facebook page for the Doomer Party 2016 group. She was responding to a press release from Stanford University titled, "Causes of California Drought Linked to Climate Change, Stanford Scientists Say." Ms. Ball's response, "Hell, my son could have told them that, and he's only 12. It's unclear to me why anybody thinks academic scientists are smarter or wiser than 12-year-olds, and the ultra-conservative nature of academic scientists should surprise nobody at this point. That about wraps it up this week. Be sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Please continue to follow my blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. I'll be hosted by Ken Hester in New Zealand in a couple of weeks. You can keep abreast of that and future speaking tours on my blog and also on Facebook. Finally, if you're finding yourself in need of support in dealing with these heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook and join the conversation. There are plenty of people going through a similar emotional roller coaster who help provide some personal insight to these monumental issues. A few days ago in that group, Lori Wearsome wrote, "I'm an older woman that cannot save my family from what is coming. I also can no longer dwell on it at all. I am powerless. What I can do is be grateful for what I have and be kind to myself and others. I must protect myself. I must care for myself. I must pursue happiness like it is my job, because I believe it is. We are all facing personal extinction from the moment we are born." There you have it. The whole story in a nutshell. Thanks, Lori. See you on the radio next Tuesday evening. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Afrazin and Rhiann Kerrigan for the music.